don't lose sight of the bigger picture. Get integrated electronic banking into your business systems. Search NetBank Bigger Picture Business Banking.
Well, the world is awash with central bank liquidity that needs to find a home at the moment thanks to COVID-19. Consensus is that this will buoy all asset classes, as was the case coming out of the global financial crisis, though the quantum of stimulus this time around dwarfs what we saw previously. A recent note from Milkwood Capital shows that foreigners own $22 trillion in U.S. assets. For 10 years, foreigners bought U.S. dollars and U.S. equities and U.S. bonds. U.S. equities still make up 58% of world equities in the MSCI All World. U.S. government bonds make up 40% of world bonds, according to the Barclays Aggregate Global Government Bond Index. But a shift has commenced, and emerging market is certainly the main beneficiary. Foreigners have started selling U.S. equities and bonds and the dollar too to buy the rest of the world currencies and rest of the world equities. And for a weaker dollar and emerging market outperformance to gain momentum, we certainly now start needing to see global growth on the rise. Well, Jeremy Grantham, the famed contrarian founder of the investment group GMO, reckons that markets have smashed past the full bull stage and are currently in a late bubble melt-up phase that rivals the two biggest bubbles of the past century. There is as much craziness now as there was in 1999 or 1929, he argues. So what could go wrong? For now, the animal spirits continue to soar into the new year. Let's welcome Chris Holdsworth, Chief Investment Strategist at Investec Wealth and Investment. Chris, welcome to the show. Welcome to the new year. As we look at the themes that are going to drive asset classes in the year ahead, it's certainly looking like the global third wave is actually gaining momentum. So let's start there with the COVID picture. What are we seeing there?
Yeah, it is concerning. And unfortunately, we still have to look at the number of infections that are out there in the world. We're still far away from the vaccine being deployed to the sort of extent that it leads to herd immunity. So in this interim period, while these vaccines are being rolled out at various paces, we still need to keep a handle on what's happening with the virus. And the latest data is not encouraging. The seven-day average is now sitting at just over 700,000 people getting infected per day. That's the highest number that we've seen yet. And what's most concerning is that the growth rate is very fast. We're up 14% week on week, which is close to the fastest growth rate that we've seen since April last year. So these new strains that we've seen in South Africa, the UK, Japan, they already are gaining a foothold. And in this interim period, there is a lot of risk of this thing getting out of hand over the next couple of months before the vaccine can take full effect.
And of course, there's historical precedent for that. We saw the second waves in the Spanish flu back in 1918 was certainly the big killer. And that seems to be the way COVID is following as well. What are we seeing in the U.S. absenteeism data?
Well, this is very interesting data. U.S. data is very granular. You can get the broad economic data for a lot of countries, but in the U.S. there's lots of surveys and you can get some really great micro data. And we can pick up the direct impact of the virus on absenteeism. And back in April, there were 2 million people that were absent from work in the U.S. That's the highest number that we've seen in the data we've got going back to 1976. And we can pick up this new wave in the absenteeism data as well. It's close to a record high. We haven't seen anything like this. The absenteeism is roughly double what we would normally see in the US. So it's far worse than the typical sort of flu season. Mm. And it's once this series starts to roll over that we'll be fully confident that we're through the problems. We know that we can't pick up everybody from a testing perspective, but we are picking up a lot of data in other ways like this.
That is fascinating. And as we know with this virus, even if you've come into contact with someone and are not necessarily sick yourself, then you've got to self-isolate. And that is obviously driving this the spike in absenteeism that we're seeing. Now, what is the progress of the vaccine rollout globally? It's obviously started here in South Africa in the new year, grabbing all the headlines because we fumbled the vaccine ball. Business now seems to be trying to help government pick it up, and hopefully there are going to be no more fumbles from here. What are we seeing globally?
Well, even though we haven't rolled out the vaccine at all in South Africa, we're not behind many countries. There are only 5 countries in the world at the moment that have vaccinated more than 1% of their population. It's Israel, the UAE, Bahrain, United States, Denmark, and the UK is pretty close. In fact, in Israel, they've inoculated over 20% of their population at this point. And if you look at the vulnerable portion of their population, they've inoculated 70% of the vulnerable. So they're pretty close already. UAE and Bahrain a bit behind them. But aside from that, the rest of the world is pretty nowhere. 0.3% of the global population has been vaccinated at this point. So it is slow at this point. We know that it's starting to accelerate. There's some good numbers coming out of the US yesterday. Some more good numbers coming out of the UK, but the vast majority of countries, places like Germany, even developed market countries, even China, they haven't vaccinated a large portion of the population despite having a vaccine that was signed off by their government some time ago. So it's slow for the moment, but hopefully it'll pick up.
And as we heard from the president last night as head of the African Union, there is a big chunk coming to Africa as well. Israel obviously rolling their vaccine out very rapidly. Difficult to make comparisons until we've got our vaccine, but clearly logistically it's a lot easier in a country like Israel than it would be here in South Africa. But speaking to the private sector here, we've got the cold chain, we've got the logistics in the pharmacies and the private hospitals as well as the state hospitals. So we hope that when we get the vaccine, we can roll it out quickly. Now, there's also been an uproar about WhatsApp as we start the new year and privacy, but Google tracks us all the time, so I really don't know what all the fuss is about. What is the Google tracking data revealing about economic activity?
It's presenting a very tricky picture because normally when we're making investments, we'd like to do it with a time horizon of 12 to 18 months or so, and sometimes longer. But we're sitting now in a very difficult position with this new wave that's coming about, but we know that a vaccine is going to be rolled out at some point. And so what the tracking data is telling us now is a massive decline in activity. People are staying at home. There are lockdowns in South Africa, but South Africa is no exception to what we're seeing in the rest of the world as this new wave gains hold. And so if we were to look at normal levels of activity in retailers, in transit, and at the workplace, activity last week was about 30% below that. In middle of December, we're about 15% below. So there's been a massive drop-off in the level of activity at those three venues. And that's partly due to the wave. It's also partly due to lockdowns. And the question is, how long does this last? And if it lasts for a couple of months, does that affect markets in the short term, knowing that the vaccine is going to be rolled out 6 months down the line? So ideally, one would like to be able to see through this, but we do know that there are going to be some choppy waters between now and the next 6 to 9 months.
It certainly gives ammunition to those who've been arguing against lockdowns as an effective measure in an environment where effectively what we're doing is just delaying the inevitable spread of this virus, but in so doing, exacting a huge economic toll. So, what is that trade-off? I think that's going to be a continued debate that we have here in South Africa over the course of the year. Another big theme this year looks to be reflation. What is the latest PMI data revealing on this front?
Yeah, this is going to be the major theme for the year ahead. There are broad expectations that inflation will be picking up over the next year. The consensus expectations, which we can touch on later, show already that there's an expectation that inflation in the US will be above 2.5% by the middle of the year. Now, the concern there is that the Fed has said we'll allow inflation to be above 2%, but they never specified what number they would be uncomfortable with. Is it 2.5 or is it 3? And if we look at the feedback that we're currently getting from companies around the world, they are guiding that their input prices are growing at the fastest rate that we've seen since 2011. And as a result, they are starting to pass on some of those costs to their customers. We know that they indicate from the PMI surveys that the amount that they're pushing on to consumers, the prices that they're pushing on is up relative to last month. The month before was up relative to the month before that. We've had 4 months of increases, and it does seem to be accelerating as well. So companies are starting to push on. We've got this broad increase in money supply, which you can talk as well, and that is seeing expectations pick up. And we have to carefully calibrate our views to take into account the fact that midway through the year, we may be getting higher inflation and a Fed that starts to express some concern about that.
That certainly worries me because if we do start to see rates tick higher, if you look at sovereign debt around the world, it could make the taper tantrum of when was it, 2013, look like child's play, Chris.
Yeah, that's exactly right. I mean, it's very interesting. If you look at total US debt to GDP, that number is now well over 100%. It's actually just below 130%. What's interesting, though, is that the US government has paid less in interest on its debt last year than the year before that, and in fact, than the year before that. So they're paying relatively small amounts on interest despite this vast stockpile of debt because interest rates are low. But now we enter this period where inflation potentially is going to be picking up. Ultimately, that means that we land up with the possibility of higher interest rates. And then in that environment, you land up with the government of the US having to make some sort of tricky allocation decisions between how much they're going to spend on interest and how much they're going to spend on stimulus and other things, at the same time that the Fed is expressing some concern. So you'll end up with the Fed and the US government having to tread a fairly fine line over the coming year, and that is probably going to be the key story linked to inflation.
At least we do have Janet Yellen now as Treasury Secretary, and she really understands the dynamics of all of this, as we do have the blue wave in the US, and we know that President-elect Joe Biden is very keen to up minimum wages, to boost stimulus and to borrow to do that. So lots of inflationary pressures in the system there. And in a note you sent through this morning, you also show that global shipping prices are on the rise. Now, is global trade picking up, or is it just a case of fewer ships and containers driving this rise in shipping costs? Because we obviously saw during the COVID crash, many of those ships were in dry dock. What's driving this?
Yeah, there are a combination of factors here. The first is massive exports coming out of China. The export numbers came out this morning from China. They're hugely strong, and they've been strong for some time. So the Chinese economy is doing what they've traditionally done. They simply switched on all the factories to allow for stimulus, and they're absolutely fine. Their economy is likely to grow quite strongly this year and even more strongly next year. So they're ramping up, and they're exporting, but they're not importing as much. And so as a result, there's a mixed match of the containers. So it's been difficult to source containers to be where they need to be at any given point in time. So the price of using containers has gone through the roof. The cost of shipping goods from Shanghai to LA has doubled over the past 3 months. The cost of shipping from Shanghai to Rotterdam has quadrupled over the past few months. And this is just another input price that's going up for all of these companies around the world. And they can only take it so far. The margins are going to get squeezed, for one. But then ultimately they will be trying to pass that on, as we're seeing in the PMI data. So it's still early days. Global inflation is still pretty low at this point, but there are a number of indicators suggesting that it is likely to pick up over the coming months. And this is a key one of them.
Chris, to my introductory comments, so the world is awash with cash. Just how much money supply has increased around the world, I'm not sure people actually realize as governments look to spend their way out of the COVID crisis. These are astronomically large figures. Just how much new money was printed during 2020?
Michael, you're completely correct. I mean, these are fantastic numbers. In the US, money supply is up 25% year on year at this point. So that's M2 money supply in particular. In Europe, it's up 10%. In Japan, it's up 10%. For the US, we've never seen a number like this. We've got data going back to 1960. We've never seen money supply up by this amount. In Europe, it's the fastest growth rate we've seen since just before the global financial crisis. And Japan, it's the fastest growth rate that we've seen since 1990. China's also up about 10% year on year. So across the globe, for the economies that are the largest, we have seen a massive increase in money supply, but particularly the US. And it hasn't been a problem up until now because there's been massive demand for money. People have been very concerned. They've wanted to sit with cash in their bank accounts. So no problem. The issue comes once the vaccine is rolled out and then that cash gets deployed. What happens at that point? Do we land up in a position where we see higher inflation, or is it the case that the Fed is very carefully able to navigate the scenario and reduce the size of their balance sheet, avoiding inflation? And there are two schools of thought here, and it's not really clear which one is dominant at this point, but we can talk about what's being priced into the market. But there's one school of thought saying during the global financial crisis, we didn't see inflation, so we won't see it now. And there's another saying, hang on, this is a far greater increase in money supply than we saw during the global financial crisis, for one. And for two, there's supply chain issues like we're seeing with the shipping costs and like we're seeing with global food prices. And as a result, this time we are likely to see higher inflation. And we're probably sitting closer to that camp. And it is a concern that midway through this year, we do land up with an increase in inflation around the world, but in the US in particular.
And we were talking about it yesterday. We're seeing the signs in not only the soft commodities, but hard commodities as well. And a lot of that, I mean, the panel was divided. Peter Major reckoned a lot of that was because of all of this money printing, while the other two panelists said, no, it's structural. This is China. China's going to grow at 9.1% this year, and that is driving demand. We haven't seen much new supply by the major miners. It's been one of the remarkable things in this latest cycle. They've shown remarkable restraint. They haven't gone and invested in new mines and new production. Now, if we have a look at what this means for the immediate signs of inflation. We did see US CPI out yesterday. I think broadly in line with consensus, it still seems to be contained at this stage. But if you look at the bond market, I mean, the US 10-year Treasury going above 1%, 1.18% I think was a recent high. The market seems to think there's a very real worry here.
Yeah, that's exactly the situation. At this point, spot inflation is not a concern. If you look across the 50 largest economies around the world, for those that reported for November, the median inflation rate was all of 0.3% year on year. There are a few economies that have now reported for December. It's around 20 or so. The median amongst those is about 0.4% year on year. So very far away from any number that would cause concern for any central bank. But given what we said earlier on about what's happening to soft commodities and the guidance that companies are providing and the shipping costs and the money supply that's up, the market is starting to get concerned about the prospect for higher inflation. And inflation expectations that are priced into the bond market have been increasing fairly materially over the past 6 months or so. It's now the case that the US bond market is pricing in inflation to average 2% over the next decade, which is roughly in line with the Fed's guidance, and the Fed will be happy with that. But what we need to consider is we've got this unprecedented increase in the money supply, and yet the market is saying inflation is going to be an ordinary number over the next decade. And even though that number has increased by a significant amount over the past few months, the question is, has it increased by enough to account for this massive increase in money supply and all the other factors that we're talking about as well? So there may well still be upside risk to inflation expectations in the US, given the data that we're seeing.
Chris, what is the other camp arguing here that will keep inflation in check? Is it just a technology argument? We're seeing people say that, well, tech means we're more efficient. We don't need to buy as much. There's the sharing economy. All of these things are keeping a lid on inflation to some extent, and the aging populations that we see in the developed world. Is that the crux of it?
That's exactly it. So the first part of that is around tech. And the example that we've seen over the past 20 years is that China came about and they massively reduced the cost of a number of goods through bringing their labor force into the broader global labor force and producing goods at low prices. So because we've seen that, and now we've seen prices decline in for various goods in real terms, that will continue to be the case as technology improves. There are some issues with that argument by itself. I mean, the price of labor in China is going up, and now we're landing up with manufacturing shifting to other countries around there, like Vietnam as an example. And so there was this major benefit from China. It's not necessarily clear that that is going to be repeated, for one. For two, there is a demographic argument as well. The fact that we haven't seen a large population increase in Japan, and that was associated with a period where there was no inflation, despite the fact that there was an increase in the money supply. And if we look at demographics for Europe and other parts of Asia, like South Korea, it suggests that they're all going down the same sort of Japanification type path, and we can expect low inflation going forward as well. But there's some issues with that as well. It is the case that we're seeing populations grow at very slow rates. And in fact, in South Korea, actually, it's just gone backwards last year for the first time on record. But it's not completely clear that is tied directly with inflation at all points. For example, that we may have a demographic theme at play, and it may mean that inflation would be lower than otherwise. But when your money supply is up by 25%, does that mean inflation is 3 instead of 4? Or does it mean inflation is 0 instead of 4? And that sort of debate we still need to argue on. So it may be pulling inflation back, but it may still be the case that inflation increases given all the factors that we've highlighted.
Now, just to move on from the inflation discussion, in all of this, we see the EU and emerging markets now starting to surprise. And as I said in the introduction, it does look like market participants are saying, right, we've had a good 10 years in the US, time to start diversifying and looking for those other pockets of growth. What are we seeing in the EU firstly?
Yeah, man. So what we've seen in Europe is the data is not great. For example, the retail sales in Europe are now negative year on year, but they're less negative than had been expected. And broadly, if you look at all the economic data that's come out over the past few months, the economic surprise index, which is an aggregation of all that data, is positive, and it's more positive than the US. So despite the fact that the data is not great, it is surprising on the upside. That's Europe relative to the US. We also need to look at what's happening in emerging markets. And for that, we should really compare to China, where we're seeing data surprise on the upside, but we're seeing it surprise on the upside by more in other emerging markets. So this broad improvement in emerging market activity and the heightened commodity prices that you're referring to, it's not simply a function of what's happening in China. China has spurred growth in other emerging markets, and they are now starting to surprise on the upside as well. So there's a broad improvement in economic surprises in Europe and in emerging markets, and not the US. And that in itself is an argument for a degree of dollar weakness, which of course was very helpful for emerging markets and very helpful for higher commodity prices by itself.
And commodity producers like ourselves and Australia, that lucky country as well, although they are rather unlucky to get a chap by the name of Steve Smith, that cheat to captain their cricket team. Now, what are we expecting for global GDP this year against this backdrop of obviously accommodative financial conditions, vaccines potentially being rolled out? How does this all feed into global GDP?
Yeah. For there, I think we need to look at it from perspective of having a look at a few regions. So we'll start with China. China, it's astounding. So the outbreak was first in Wuhan. There was a massive hit growth in February. Nonetheless, the growth expectations for China for last year is that growth was positive and was plus 2%. It's the only G20 country that's going to see positive growth for 2020. So it's an astounding recovery by itself. But in addition to that, as you referenced earlier, the expectation is that growth for China next year is going to be above 8%. Some saying 9, some saying 8. It's going to be very strong. But they're not growing off a negative base. They grew already, and now they're growing by even more. So any countries and companies that have hitched themselves to the Chinese economic engine are likely to be experiencing a good time now and a good time over the coming 12 months as well. That's on the Chinese side. For the US, growth is likely to be of the order of about minus 4% for last year, which is a very sizable hit. But growth for next year is likely to recover that. So the US economy by the end of this year is back where it was at the beginning of last year. So a full 2 years to recover the damage from COVID, which is fairly swift if one were to go back and compare to previous sort of recessions. In Europe, it takes a bit longer. There was a much bigger hit last year in Europe than in the US. So despite the fact we're going to see faster growth in Europe this year than in the US, they're coming off a much lower base. And in Europe, it takes about 2 years to recover the damage from COVID. South Africa, it takes about 3 years. We're quite similar to the UK. So broadly speaking, we've got China, which is recovered already and launching. We've got the US, which is going to recover by the end of this year, Europe the end of next year, and then South Africa and the UK only the end of the year after that. And these are consensus expectations, but they're also the expectations of the IMF. And if we were to look at the Saab forecast, they're not materially different from that. So the broad view across the globe is that we in the UK take a bit longer to recover than Europe, which takes a bit longer than the US.
And how do you see that then playing out in earnings as we head into fourth quarter earnings season tomorrow with some of the big banks reporting?
Yeah, we are going to see some very large numbers from an earnings perspective. There was a massive hit to earnings over the last year. And as the recovery comes about in terms of growth, but also the vaccine being rolled out, we're going to see some pretty amazing earnings numbers, the likes of which we haven't really seen before, given the terrible base. So as an example, European earnings are currently expected to be up close to 40% year on year over the coming 12 months. Emerging markets are expected to be up about 30%. And the US, less so, expected to be up 20%. These are huge growth numbers. And if you look at what's coming out of China, these numbers are quite reasonable. Industrial profits are growing in China at well over 15% year on year. So what we're seeing for the rest of the world is really just an expectation of that being rolled out to the rest of the world at a lag. And that will see some pretty strong earnings numbers.
Remarkable. COVID crisis? What COVID crisis? It looks like a return to the roaring 20s. Chris Holdsworth, Chief Investment Strategist at Investec Wealth and Investment.
Don't lose sight of the bigger picture. Experience growth through cross-border trade. Search NetBank Bigger Picture Business Banking